All right. As usual, I have lots of notes which basically repeat what you already know from reading the book, but I'd much rather talk about stuff than do that. So what I thought I would do instead was to talk very briefly about some of the things raised by that chapter and then see if I could get what your comments and responses were. I did want to say that the book itself that chapter is in might be one place to look for paper ideas. That the chapter has a footnote about Japanese private law under the Tokugawa shogunate. There's a chapter that I think has Chinese and Korean, and a chapter that has Chinese and Japanese stuff. So if you don't have an idea for a paper, you might just sort of glance through the book and see if seems to have pointers to information that would make a nice paper. So before I start talking about stuff, first, what were your initial responses to what you read in that chapter? What seemed interesting, puzzling, whatever about it? Anybody? Yeah?
Well, I thought it was interesting that the magistrates didn't have legal training, they had to rely on legal training.
But we know that already, because that was true of our earlier reading in the Chinese stuff as well. I was noticing, compared to the Tibetan stuff, that they mentioned that part of the staff was the magistrates, people who traveled with him when he moved from one province to another, and part of it was locals who stayed in place and presumably gave you some continuity. And that was one of the characteristics of the Tibetan system as well.
In a number of the cases, they were rid of statutes. There were no elements of the code that were signed in at all. It was largely based on local custom, how the decisions were made. And so it made me think that perhaps this was a system that was probably well suited for the Chinese expanded into perhaps even cultures that they can apply the local customs.
Yeah, and I think there are a number of the things there suggest that the Chinese law that actually worked was, in a sense, less formal and statutory than as it's described in the cases which we were looking at before, which obviously would tend to be along those lines. Yeah? That is, the practice is sophisticated. The law hardly exists, but the
structure. Period.
That's right. What they're doing does not seem strikingly less sophisticated than our contract practice. Yeah.
I was just going to note, it was interesting how they were kind of focused on self-enforcement and had creative ways to
There's a sense in which part of what I find interesting is that the whole question of how do you run contractual practice without contract law or state enforcement. And that's a slight exaggeration, because there's a little bit of law and there's a little bit of state enforcement, but at least the implication of the chapter is almost that if the magistrate had closed up for 5 years, it wouldn't have mattered that most of what they're doing. So one of the things that's worth thinking about is, why is this interesting aside from understanding China? If you ask the question, how do you set up contractual practice so that you never go to court? All right. What are a number of the reasons that's an interesting question, quite aside from understanding 19th century China? Why might you care about it first? Forget about scholarship. You're going to be practicing attorneys. Why would you like to know the answer to that question?
Well, as a client, I mean, you would want to avoid the cost of litigation.
That's right. So the one part of it is to ask, since maybe you as a lawyer are going to betray your clients and try to get them into lots of cases so you can bill them many hours, but assuming that you're loyal employees or whatever, your agents or something for your clients, you want to set up their contracts in ways in which it is as unlikely as possible that they will actually ever have to go to court to enforce them. It's not the only thing you want, so obviously, you know, you're going to have some trade-offs. And so the observation of how they solve that set of problems in this society, it seems to me, is of significant real-world relevance if you're actually going to be doing contract design. That you'd like to just borrow those ideas that are relevant and to say, well, look, maybe there are some advantages to a contract that has caveat vendetur, but on the other hand, caveat vendetur means you don't have to sue people. It just means you've got the thing, it doesn't work, you know, you swallow that loss. You're going to want to pay a lower price if the other guy doesn't guarantee the product, but on the other hand, it saves the necessity to go to court if there's a problem. Yeah.
I was also struck by how rare it was to award money damages, that even the few commercial statutes that existed with those, they had inconsistent decision. And so it made me wonder whether how well that motivated people to actually take their claims to court, and they wouldn't receive restitution. All they would receive is that would be the threat that the person that, you know,
but it did sound from his description of the actual cases as though on paper it was all penal, but as though in practice the penal was largely a threat to force performance. That it was reminding me of one of the features that I noticed when I was reading about Jewish law, which we'll get into later, which is that a court cannot divorce a woman from her husband without the husband's permission. That basically you're starting out with a legal system in which husbands can pretty easily divorce their wives and the wives cannot at all divorce their husbands. Eventually, by about the 10th century, the courts decide there are legitimate grounds on which the wife can demand a divorce. But we can't give it to her. So all we can do is to lock up the husband and say, we won't let you out until you divorce your wife. Or beat the husband and say, we'll beat you every day until you divorce your wife. Which has the same effect. But formally, they can't do it themselves. And there are contexts like that in U.S. laws. I think the chapter mentions that there are cases where the court can't make you testify to something, but they can hold you in contempt of court if you don't. And that's really an analogous case. And it sounded here as though the actual results of the few cases that went to court were not normally that somebody got beaten, which is what was supposed to happen in terms of the law, but that somebody was told, pay half the money you owe or else you'll be beaten. Or at least that was the implication, I think.
Also, maybe wonder how effective that would be among local merchants, that you probably would want your money back if the deal had gone poorly, but if your business associate was punished by the court and they destroyed the business relationship that you have.
A different way of putting it, one of the issues, some of this stuff we're going to get into next time because you've got my article on From China to Cyberspace, which is tying this with some of the stuff at my other seminar. But if you're trying to imagine you're trying to set up a contract in such a way that it will not be in the interest of either party to default. All right. So imagine that in our world you are hiring somebody to build a house on your property or on his property. But either way, make it his property first for a moment. And suppose that you don't expect to go to court, or you don't trust the courts, or something, for whatever reason. One of the things you could do is say, "All right, we've agreed it's going to cost $100,000 to build the house. Here's $100,000. Now build the house." Why might that be a foolish thing to do? He walks off with the money and then never builds the house, right? Well, you say, that's all right, so we'll do it the other way around. We'll say, here's the house I want. When you finish building it, I'll give you $100,000. Why might that also not be an ideal contract from the standpoint of one of the parties? You may not pay him. Now, that's a little tricky. He could claim he owns the house, especially if it's on his property. But even if it's on his property, if the house is one that's been customized to your particular desires... If he tries, suppose he got his house which was worth $100,000 to you and you were willing to pay that initially, was your agreement, he can only sell it for $60,000. So if you don't have court enforcement, what do you do on the day when he's just showed you what a nice house he's built and asked for $100,000? What is your response, assuming that you have no moral compunctions? Yeah, maybe $65,000, but right. That is, you say to him, I'm sorry, but things have worked out. I just don't have as much money as I thought I would. The bank was very tight on giving me a loan. I'm sure we can reach some understanding, but not $100,000. Something less than that, limited only at the bottom by what you can sell it to somebody else. So in practice, how do you think one would and does solve that problem? How do you try to structure the contract to minimize those two problems? But in particular, you have progress payments designed in order that neither person at any point can stop and say, I'm getting a large gain. But now we have a further problem in this, and that is that neither cost nor value is perfectly predictable in advance. So you set up the contract, and you could imagine cases where on your initial estimate, the payment schedule was such that it didn't pay either you to default. But in fact, because the costs have gotten higher than he expected, or because the house is worth more or less to you at some point in the process. And sort of the problem you run into in solving this is I can always reduce the risk that you will want a default by shifting the initial terms in my favor, right? If you are buying, how do I make you less likely to default? You give me a big deposit at the beginning, which I keep if you default. If you're selling, how do we do it? Very small deposit. The problem is that anything along those lines that makes you less likely to default makes me more likely to default. Because after all, if I default, I keep that big deposit. Or again, I'm assuming that we don't have recourse to the court for some reason. Is there any way of solving that puzzle? Is there any way in which we can arrange the contract so that we have terms that give you an incentive not to default without increasing my incentive to default? How would you do that if you were very clever? This is a solution that people felt came up with thousands of years ago. Yep.
You have to get a third person
who trusts the book. That's not what I was thinking of, but you're right. A third way, and one of the things the Chinese did use, as described in the book, is you find a reliable third party. And that's really, if you think about reputational enforcement, that's sort of how you borrow someone else's reputation if you don't have one. But I was thinking of a different solution, yeah?
Well, you build some kind of self-enforcing or self-executing agreement into the actual contract,
but
so that the contract becomes the law or the court between the two of you.
You might. There have been suggestions for what are called smart contracts, which basically involve computer programs which somehow are getting inputs that tell them what's happened and release the money in the safe deposit box only when certain things happen. I was thinking of a simpler and older solution. And I'll give you the solution, and then I'll tell you a story, which is the case where it didn't work quite a long time ago. And that solution is a hostage. That is to say, I give you a deposit, which it hurts me to lose, but doesn't help you to get. That's, if you think of the underlying idea of a hostage, if you kill my hostage, if you kill my son or my wife or my brother or whoever it is, doesn't do you any good, but it hurts me a whole lot. That's your threat if I default on our deal. And it won't cost you anything to do that. Whereas, but it doesn't give you an incentive to default because you don't gain by it. And it doesn't always work. I'm thinking of the following story. I don't know. Do any of you know, do the names Stephen and Matilda mean anything to you in English history? All right. Yes? No? All right. A little bit after the Norman Conquest, there was a succession dispute. King Henry I, I think, dies. He has no son. He has a daughter who has been married at one point to the Holy Roman Emperor and therefore is referred to as the Empress Matilda, although she's not empress at this point of anything. I think maybe her husband had died or something. And what Henry wants to do is to pass the crown on to Matilda's son when and if she has one. She can't inherit under English law at the time. But it's possible, it's a matter of dispute, that you can inherit through her. So Henry tries to swear everybody in sight before he dies to support his daughter on behalf of her heirs for controlling England. When he dies, however, I think, cousin by the name of Stephen, I think maybe a nephew of the king or something, happens to be more or less on sight. His brother is, I think, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and promptly crowns him king. And there is then about a 14-year civil war, a very messy and bloody and unpleasant civil war, between the supporters and Stephen and Matilda, going back and forth between points at which one side seems to win and points at the other. Eventually, there's a compromise peace in which it's agreed that Stephen will be the king for the rest of his life, but that Matilda's son, who ends up as Henry II, will inherit. In the middle of all of this, there's a baron called Gilbert Marshall, who initially he's on Stephen's side. Very early he sells out to Matilda, and being more honest than the average baron in that civil war, he stays on Matilda's side for the rest of the civil war. And at one point in the civil war, Gilbert is holding a castle, and Stephen shows up in front of it with an army and demands to surrender. And Gilbert doesn't think he can hold the castle against a long siege, but sieges are expensive, so he says, look, I got a deal for you, Stephen. The deal is that I will send a message to Matilda asking her to bring an army and relieve the siege to help me. If she doesn't do so in 3 days, I'll surrender so you won't have to have a siege or an attack or anything. And Stephen says, well, that's a pretty good deal. I don't believe Matilda's got an army that she can bring here in 3 days, but how do I know you'll perform this contract we're making? And he says, well, you can have the kid. My son, William, one of my sons, you can take him, and if I don't perform, you can kill him. And so they agree to this contract, and Stephen goes off with his army and does whatever he wants to do for the next 3 days, sieging someone else's castle or something. And Gilbert spends 3 days hiring soldiers, bringing in supplies, and getting ready for a siege. And Stephen comes back and says, 3 days have passed, Matilda's not showed up, surrender the castle. And Gilbert says, ha ha, fooled you. And Stephen says, then I'll kill the kid. And Gilbert says, have I not 3 other sons? And still the anvil and the hammer with which to make more? And Stephen, who I guess was probably too tender-hearted for that particular civil war, does not actually end up killing the boy. And William grows up to be probably the top tournament knight in Western Europe, and before he dies, regent of England for John's son after King John dies. He's one of the more famous figures of 12th century English history, which is why we have the rest of the story, because he ended up being an important person. But in any case, but that's a nice case where the problem was either, we don't know, either the problem was that the hostage really wasn't worth enough to guarantee performance, or else that Gilbert correctly guessed that Stephen wouldn't carry through on his threat. But it does illustrate a point. This is all sort of roundabout. I'm getting back to the question of why you as a merchant would go to the district magistrate given that he's not going to compel performance, or at least only partial performance. But one answer is that you can think of the district magistrate as a sort of a hostage, or rather his actions as. Because I've got a threat. My threat is if you violate the contract, I'll report you to the district magistrate. May not do me much good, but it's going to get you in a lot of trouble. So that's a case in which I've got the equivalent of a hostage, a way in which I can do something that I don't have an incentive to do if you perform. First, it'll be harder to persuade the magistrate if you haven't cheated me and I want to claim that you have. But in addition to that, I've got no reason to, because I'm not going to get anything out of it. But it's a way of punishing you for non-performance, and therefore is a way of enforcing the contract. So that's sort of one way you can think of that particular situation, if that makes sense. That it's sort of not that the court exists to give a just verdict, but that the court exists to give people an incentive to follow through in their contract. Yeah.
Right, because if you're not getting reimbursed fully, it keeps the litigation down until it's really worth it for you and you want to punish the person,
yep,
regardless of your loss.
Yes. And, of course, the question of damaging the relationship with him is sort of two-edged, because on the one hand, you don't want the reputation of somebody who gets his people to deal with him in trouble. On the other hand, you might want the reputation of somebody who gets people who try to cheat him in trouble. So I want to sort of go back to this question of why this stuff is still interesting outside of the historical context. So one reason is because an ordinary contract lawyer would like to take advantage of some of these approaches to try to write contracts people won't choose to try to break. Can you think of areas in the modern world where people are in fact making contracts which they can't get courts to enforce? Because I would claim that quite a lot of that is going on at the moment, and routinely does. What?
Contracts for illegality.
That's one of them, is in illegal markets. Correct. I was in fact just thinking in the context of the point about what reputation you want, of the interesting issue of what so-called organized crime really is. Because I think there are pretty good economic reasons to believe it's not a General Motors of crime. That large firms require a lot of information flow up and down in order that the guy at the top can make sure the guys at the bottom are doing what they ought to be. And that's very costly when that information will get you put in jail if the wrong people get it. So I think if you really look at criminal enterprises, most of them are very small firms, sort of family firm size, not General Motors size. So then what's organized crime? Well, part of what organized crime is, I think, is a Better Business Bureau. That is to say, a set of relations among people in the criminal industry, one of whose purposes, I think, if I read it correctly, is after you've swindled me, and before I hire a hitman to kill you, I want to make sure that the other people I deal with know that the reason I'm having you killed is that you swindled me. So therefore, I go to the local capo and I say, look, here's what happened. You can ask him to come in and get his side of the story. You can give us a verdict. You have no enforcement mechanism for the verdict, but I got an enforcement mechanism. Like everybody else here, I know the phone number of a hitman. And what I want from you is that if he doesn't pay me what he owes me, that you will tell other people that, you know, he was the bad guy, and so you shouldn't worry about doing business with me. Unless you're going to cheat me. Yeah.
It sounds like the guilt then in Taiwan a little bit, that they were self-enforcing within the guilt, but not necessarily outside of the
guilt. Yeah, no, that would be the case, I think. But anyway, I guess the first point I was making is that one of the contexts in which we deal with contracts that we don't use the courts to enforce is criminal. What's another huge one? Let us suppose, for example, that the Iranian government makes a deal, as in fact the Korean government once or twice has made a deal. And the Iranian government says, we will promise that we will stop getting our uranium up to higher levels of purity in exchange for your doing X, Y, and Z for us. What is the obvious problem with this arrangement? There's no enforcement mechanism. That's right. That international deals, some of which we call treaties and things of that sort, are in effect in an anarchy. They are deals made among powers which don't have a superior power that can enforce the deal. And therefore, the basic logic of what we're looking at here is very much the logic of, in international relations, how do you arrange your deals with each other in such a way that they are likely to be carried out when you know that if somebody breaks it, you can't stop them. All right? So that it just struck me that those are sort of three different ways in which what seems of only academic interest is actually of real-world interest. It's, if you want to understand criminal marketplaces, if you want to think about international relations, and just if you want to structure contracts that will minimize litigation. Now, one other case that's occurred to me is that there are various informal contracts, such that if any of you are married or even have long-term roommates, you may have some contracts with the person who shares your house with you about who does what. And you're not going to sue each other, and it's worth thinking and structuring those contracts, how you set them up to minimize the same sorts of problems they're trying to minimize here. All of that make sense to people? All right, so now, before I discuss how they do it, let me again stop talking, which I'm very bad at doing, the stopping part, and see if you have observations either on the chapter or questions about the chapter or on the stuff we've just been talking about that would make a useful punctuation so I don't have to give a lecture, which I'm not supposed to be doing in seminars if I can help it. Comments? Anybody? Nobody? Yeah?
I was just thinking about, as you're saying, international systems and yet it's still possible to have self-enforcement. And like some things that states often do is have confidence building measures, like small steps, sort of things that reveal that they're, you know, trustworthy and will eventually follow through on their agreements.
For example, a little bit of a different question. At the moment, the U.S. owes a great deal of money. The U.S. government owes large amounts of money to people outside the country, largely China, but other people as well. Well, we've got a solution to the deficit problem, don't we? Right? All we've got to do is renege on all those debts, and we've just dropped the national debt to, you know, half or a third or a quarter of its present level. And, you know, the president is very worried about the national debt. He's talking about, you know, only introducing one expensive new project instead of 10 next year in order not to have too large a deficit. So why don't we just, you know, write it off? Who are they going to do? Are they going to sue us? Yeah. Well, it's interesting. It's an interesting question. Are they more likely to ally with you if you haven't defaulted on your sovereign debt? Countries do sometimes default on their sovereign debt, not very often, but it's been known to happen. Why, in deciding to ally with somebody, would you care whether they had paid someone else what they owed them?
Well, because they made a promise to somebody else that in exchange for
the problem, you may well be right. The problem with that argument is that they aren't a person. That is, your argument makes quite a lot of sense if you're thinking about the individual, because you say some individuals are moral people who feel badly about cheating others, some aren't, and when, by my behavior you can learn something about my insides, as it were, and hear what I'm like. It's a little, it may be true by analogy. It's a little less clear when you're talking about the government, because suppose, after all, that there's an election, the opposition party comes into power. I'm not thinking about the U.S. in particular, anywhere. And the opposition party says, well, those rogues who were here before made some promises to you, but they're not us.
Well, if you're here before your terms of office, which I would say some major problems are right now, I'm not.
Yes, but the same thing. It could be a coup d'etat. You can think of a variety of ways. It could just be that the tyrant dies and somebody else takes over. All I'm saying is, it may well be that one advantage for tyranny or dictatorship is that you really have a person who's there, and people can really say, we can deduce the characteristics of the country by the characteristics of that person. And you know the traditional definition of an honest politician? One who stays bought. Which is in a sense the same issue, because of course another area I should have mentioned and didn't is politics. Right, politics is surely full of contracts. Every time that I say, if you'll give me a vote on my bill today, I'll give you a vote on your bill next week, that's a contract. I'm sure, though I don't know, but I'm sure sort of a priori, that every time you're approaching an election year, there are people who are saying, look, if you'll support my candidate in the 7th district, I won't get someone to run against your candidate in the 9th district. All sorts of deals of that sort. None of those are enforceable in the courts. So, now I haven't thought about how it applies to that particular world, but that's another big marketplace, as it were, the political marketplace, in which people have to worry about contracts they can't enforce. But anyway, so that might be an advantage of dictatorship, but if you think about a democracy, or even a non-democracy, but one in which you don't have a single... I mean, China isn't really single-person rule in any meaningful sense at this point, even though it's not a democracy, and you could easily...
Yeah, but it's hard to have an opinion, say, a party in power or such a thing that is, by its own portrayal, very unified, and then say, well, those are...
Yeah. No, I think there's clearly some truth to what you're saying, that to some extent we do sort of imagine organizations as people. You think of, firms go to a good deal of trouble, after all, to persuade you that the firm sort of has a face, that, you know, Google is like this, and Apple is like that, and Microsoft is really worried about the fact that people hate them. And, you know... It's not that they hate Bill Gates in particular, it's they think of not everybody, there are a bunch of people in the computer world at least who think of Microsoft as sort of an evil empire kind of thing. So we do that, and maybe part of it is just that we've got hard wiring very well designed for dealing with human beings, and we try to use it for as many other things as we can. But so in a sense, what you're really talking about is reputational enforcement. Or maybe not, but maybe it's two things. Yeah.
There's also a self interest aspect of it too, especially in the example of the debt to the Chinese.
Yes.
Comparative advantages in trade situations for the countries, the value of various currencies involved in the exchanges, and just renege on that debt.
If we renege on the debt, we can still trade. They'll just want stuff instead of paper.
Except for they're the ones who make all the stuff, and what we make is paper. I mean, that's a vast oversimplification.
Yeah.
All I'm trying to say is there's self-interest involved in the parties who are making.
If we can't lend them money, then the exchange rate will shift to the point at which they want to buy as much of our stuff as we want to buy of their stuff, because they're not going to give us stuff for nothing. And if we can't give them, they might, instead of lending stuff, they might buy stock or something. But basically, the only way you're going to have a quote imbalance of trade is if there's a capital flow to balance it. Because, you know, every time that a American buys Chinese currency to buy Chinese goods, somebody has sold that currency, which means there's somebody with Chinese currency who wants dollars. What do you use dollars for? You use them to buy U.S. assets or to buy U.S. goods. So in that sense, but... I mean, you can think of lots of possible reasons. I guess I'm just making the point that there again, you've got contracts that people that you want to get enforced, and you might want to be a little careful. That is, I could certainly imagine circumstances in which we're saying for a particular country, it's not prudent to buy their debt. Because some, not all countries have AAA ratings. In fact, it's not good. The U.S. is going to keep having them. There was a story sometime in the last few days of somebody at Moody's or somebody who was saying that they thought that the U.S. might lose its present very high credit rating as things were going because the deficit was getting so high. But so how do you do it? The one of the ways that you do it that we were discussing is you try to structure the pattern of payments in such a way that either party, if it sort of cuts things off at one point, won't have any large gain. But you can't always do that, partly because of the uncertainties that if I'm buying grain that you're going to deliver in 3 months, neither of us knows what the price is going to be. So if we set it up by agreeing on a price now, which maybe I'd like to do because I'd like to be locked in for so as not to gamble on future prices, then one of us could be a whole lot better off canceling it if the price goes either up or down either way. So we can't always do that. And, of course, there are lots of other issues other than just defaulting on the contract. There are issues like, you know, do I take care of the goods or not? Are the goods of good quality and so forth and so on. So one problem is minimizing the temptation to breach. Another one was pointed out a few minutes ago, and that's to the extent that what prevents breach is reputation. How do we... Let's go back to my house building. All right. This time, I'm having a house built, and I'm having it built by a firm that builds 500 houses a year. And let us suppose that the nature of the uncertainties is such that we can't figure out a way of structuring the contract that won't have the characteristic that under some circumstances either I or they can profit by just cutting it short, by reneging. All right, there are uncertainties in the situation such that we could have me make a big prepayment, but that'll mean that under some circumstances it'll pay them to stiff me. We could have me give no prepayment at all, but then under some circumstances it'll pay me too. How do we decide who to trust? If we can't get rid of the temptation, where do we want to put it? If they have a reputation already, I was thinking of a slightly different version of that, which is the side which has the greatest value for a reputation. I'm not a repeat player. If I cheat them so nobody will build me another house for the next 10 years, that's fine. This house is going to last for 50 years. If they cheat me, they've got a whole line of potential customers next year. I'll spread the word. Maybe I'll get a newspaper story on it and so forth. So one of the things you can do, and one of the things I suspect the Chinese are doing, since they've got contractual mechanisms for shifting risk, one of the things they can use them for is to set it up so that the party who has to be trusted is whichever party has the strongest reputational incentive to keep its word. All right. And then we get to your solution, which you mentioned earlier. Suppose neither one does. How do we solve the case where if, and we've got this situation right now, you buy what purports to be a fine 15th century painting on eBay. If you pay them and they then send you the painting, what might you discover? It's a fake, right? If they send you the painting and you inspect it and then pay them, what might happen? I don't pay them. So what do you actually do in that situation? Real world solution happens routinely. Where does the painting and the money go? What?
A letter of credit.
A letter of credit would still be a payment of money, but...
You have a broker.
You have an escrow agency, essentially, whatever you're going to call it. You have some trusted third party, and they send the painting to the trusted third party. I go inspect the painting. If I don't like it, they send it back. And if I do like it, I hand the money over to the trusted third party. They hand me the painting. Money goes to the seller. All right, that's a perfectly standard procedure. And you were pointing out a different version of the same thing in the version that shows in here. I want to borrow money. You don't trust me to pay it. But he, for whatever reason, is in a position to know that I'm reliable. Maybe he's my uncle or something. He can use family pressures against me. And he's got a reputation. So in that case, I leverage his reputation by his guaranteeing the loan. So that's the same mechanism, but they're both examples where you take advantage of the fact that there are some people out there against whom reputational incentive is powerful, and therefore some people out there who can be trusted, and we try to trust those people who have reasons to be trustworthy, as it were, if that makes sense. One of the mechanisms you might get, and I don't see any evidence here that the Chinese are using, is that people will, like it's sort of related to it, is that people will either interact with people with against whom they've got, as it were, non-legal leverage. So if you think about, let me take a real example, which I was just discussing with somebody, I think, yesterday, which is, at some point in the next couple of years, I'm thinking of spending a semester on the East Coast visiting at George Mason University, which has some interesting people I'd like to talk with. If so, I'll probably want a house sitter. And somebody said, well, that's easy. You just, you know, go up on the web and advertise for a house sitter. That's not a great idea, you know. Where would I actually go to find a house sitter? Maybe, but what I would more likely do, I think, my wife's a fairly active member of her church. I'm fairly active in my, not that active, but active enough in my medieval hobbies. I would find some social network that I am a part of or that she is a part of, where we can both get information about a potential person and where the potential person has a reason not to trash the house, because even if they don't have reputational incentives in the wide world, they have reputational incentives in that particular little world. And part of what's interesting about this is that a very common economic pattern is to have particular niche markets dominated by ethnicities. So I think I'm told that in Los Angeles, all of the donut shops, or I forget what they are, you know, let me say Armenian, I'm just making that one up, but they're all something like that. And I think that's a not uncommon pattern you get in the U.S. and maybe even more abroad, because the U.S. has a relatively functional legal system. But if you're in a place with a very poor legal system, there's a lot to be said for arranging so that the business, your business dealings are with people who are part of a group where if you cheat one of them, everyone else in the group will know about it, and your son won't be able to marry their daughter because he wants to marry into a family of lowlifes like that. And, you know, you can run through the potential mechanisms. I've seen the same phenomenon in a different context, one which is actually getting a little closer to what we'll be talking about next time. Usenet is a part of the internet which looks like a whole lot of bulletin boards, although it's physically constructed differently than a bulletin board is. It's basically, each one of them is a conversation on some topic among people all over the world online. And one of the things I've noticed is that Usenet groups vary a good deal in how polite they are. And I think of the groups I've experienced, probably the nicest one, though it isn't active anymore, it exists but has very little traffic nowadays, was one associated with my medieval historical recreation hobby. And I think the reason it was nice was not the people in that hobby are any nicer than anybody else, but that if you insulted somebody, the odds were pretty good that he knew somebody who knew you in the real world. So that in that sense, you cared about your reputation in that little world, and little world in the sense that it was a few thousand people, even if they were spread around, mostly around the U.S., but a few of them in Canada and other places. And therefore, you had an incentive to sort of monitor your behavior. And this is in a way related. One of the people that George Mason actually used to be here is an economist called Larry Iannacone, whose specialty is economics of religion. And I first met him when he gave a very interesting talk, which had to do with a puzzle. And the puzzle is that the U.S. is an open market for religions. There's nothing to stop you from starting your own religion or your own variant of some existing religion. And yet there are some religions which seem to impose pointless costs on their members. So if you think of an Orthodox Jew keeping kosher, or a Hare Krishna shaving his head, or a Mormon not drinking tea and coffee and Coke as well as alcohol, you can see why a religion would want to say, if you want to be an active member of our church, you've got to contribute some money to the church. We can use that for building the religion. But why do they, in effect, say, if you want to be an active member of our church, you've got to throw some money in the ocean every year, which is a way of thinking of these characteristics. And Larry said, you'd think that with a competitive market for religions, anytime there was such a religion, some clever person would create a variant on the religion which had all the same useful characteristics, but left out kosher. So we become Reformed Jews instead of Orthodox Jews. And why doesn't that always happen? And part of his answer was that some but not all religions, and he was suggesting that you could think of these as the ones that you were more likely to think of as sects rather than religions, are deliberately set up to partly cut off their membership from interaction outside of the religion. So that if you set it up so that if you've got a shaved head because you're a Hare Krishna, everybody else thinks you're nuts, and therefore it's likely that most of the people you deal with and most of your friends are going to be Hare Krishnas. If you're an Orthodox Jew, there's this problem of having dinner with anybody who isn't an Orthodox Jew because they aren't keeping kosher and so forth. And so the argument was that there's a real advantage to this, because you now have a pool of people who are, as it were, mutually dependent, know each other, interact with each other. And that's a valuable thing, and you can get it by these somewhat costly ways of doing things that cut people off from easy interaction with other people. He had further arguments along those lines. Larry's an interesting guy. One of the interesting things about Larry, by the way, is that he has two religions. One of them is he is a strongly believing Christian, and the other is he's an economist. And so you therefore have somebody who is simultaneously a scholar objectively studying a phenomenon and a deeply committed part of that same phenomenon that he is studying. At least that was my interpretation, knowing him. That seemed pretty clearly to be the case. Which religion he has more faith, more commitment to, I don't know. But he didn't seem to see them as in conflict. Alright, so other things, other tactics that we use, as may be obvious in terms of what we'll be talking about next time, another world where all this stuff is relevant is online. All right? Online interactions, normal jurisdictional boundaries are transparent. Most of the time, if you do a search for a book you want to read, you want to buy, you don't know whether it's in England, or you probably notice if it's in India because the prices are in rupees, but mostly you don't care what country it's in, but that means that actually enforcing contracts in that context gets hard. And so that's why I suggest in this article you'll be reading for next time that there is a fairly close analogy between the problem faced by the Taiwanese merchants and the problem faced by people who want to do business online and who want to figure out ways of structuring their business that don't depend on court enforcement, and indeed that the equivalent of the chop, which is the seal that was used in China as a signature essentially, is the digital signature. That's just a high-tech version of the chop. They've got the same basic logic, a way of proving that I signed a document. So Other things you do. Part of the pattern I think we're observing is that you minimize the need to change the outcome. If you think of the sort of rule, let the costs lie where they fall. All right, that's one possible legal rule. And again, when we get to Jewish law, you have some rather interesting cases where the costs might fall in either of two ways, and whichever it is, we leave it. This is the case where the court is unsure whether I owe you 50 zoos or 100 zoos. And so the court verdict is, they'll only make me give you 50 zoos. But if you have, being an enterprising person, seized 100 zoos of my property, they won't make you give it back. So that's a let the outcome lie as it is. Similarly, in these cases, it seems to be the rules that are being described are designed so far as possible so that the legally not in the sense of statute, but in the sense of the contract rules, the legally obligatory result is as close as possible to what will happen if you do nothing. All right, so that, for example, the clearest example of that is the rule of caveat emptor. All right, caveat emptor says, I delivered to you, 500 beef carcasses, just like I agreed to. You accepted them. 5 days later, you discover that half of them are rotten. Tough luck. It was your responsibility to inspect them when you got them. And quite aside from tough luck, what that means is that you don't have to sue me to get the legally mandated result, because the legally mandated result is I don't owe you anything. All right? You've got the carcasses for whatever they are or aren't worth. Similarly, a rule in which ownership generally goes very closely with possession. All right, if we have rules in which, as a general rule, you only own it at the point when you've taken possession of it, then we don't have the problem of I've got it, you claim you own it, you've got to have the court make me give it to you. Similarly, with the whole issue of contracts where there's been no performance at all. All right, if you say, well, look, you promised that next month you would sell me 500 bushels of wheat for 50 cents a bushel, yeah, maybe I did. Maybe I even promised in writing. But you haven't paid me any money. I haven't given you any wheat. It hasn't happened. All right? Again, it seems to me that, now, it's not totally true, obviously. I mean, I'm all obviously oversimplifying because you can't structure your contracts so there are never any problems. But you can structure them to minimize problems, and it seems to me that describes what they're doing, and that a lot of that is to structure it in such a way that you don't have a right to get something that requires some positive action to get. And obviously, when you're structuring the contract that way, that will all show up, as it were, in prices, that if you want to buy a product with a guarantee, you'll probably end up paying more than a product without a guarantee. What is a guarantee in our system? A guarantee is a contractual shift from caveat emptor to caveat vendor. Are people familiar with these terms? I don't know if they're... All right, you are. I thought it was sort of part of this. All right. See what I mean when I say a guarantee? If you have a legal rule which says, if my car breaks down, that's my problem, and you, the seller, say, we're going to give you a 50,000-mile guarantee, you've just said that for 50,000 miles, if the car breaks down, that's your problem. So you've just changed the rule in that respect from caveat emptor to caveat vendor. And what this suggests is that the less available mechanisms for enforcing contracts are, the less sensible it is to try to do that. Because the great advantage of the caveat emptor is that nobody has to go to court. There are disadvantages, of course. That's not saying you would never want it. Obviously, people do give guarantees, but only that... There's something to be said for doing it in that fashion. Similarly, you all presumably know what liquidated damages are. You've covered that at some point or other. And liquidated damages, in some ways, are a very attractive solution, even in our system, because they avoid any litigation over how much I owe you. All right, we agreed when we signed the contract, if I don't perform, I owe $50,000. And when you go into a long discussion of why you do or don't do that and why they are or are not always enforceable. But still in our system, to actually get that $50,000, you may have to sue me. Not in the Chinese case. Because in the Chinese case, if we have $50,000 liquidated damages, at the point when I breach the contract, where are those $50,000 sitting? In the Taiwanese approach to this problem. We sign a contract and we want it set up so that if I breach the contract, you'll get $50,000. How do we arrange for that to happen? The $50,000 is in your strong box. That's right. And when I breach it, you say, well, I got the $50,000. Now that has the obvious problem that you now have an incentive to breach yourself to keep the money. And then we need, maybe you're somebody who's got a reputation and be trusted, maybe that's a sufficiently blatant violation so that we'll get you to the district magistrate, but it does mean that the liquidated damages in one direction we can implement without ever having to go to court. And that's sort of an attractive feature of that particular system. Another thing you'd like to do and again, you'd always like to do, but especially would like to do in this kind of system, is to minimize ambiguity. To try to set it up so that there are as few cases as possible where, well, there's an argument for saying that I owe you the money, and there's an argument for saying I don't owe you the money. This is something, by the way, that also sort of struck me. There's a general issue in thinking about legal systems of the difference between bright line rules and standards. All right, a bright line rule says if you're driving faster than 65 miles an hour, we'll give you a ticket. A standard says if you are driving faster than is safe given the circumstances, we'll give you a ticket. And you can see there are advantages for both. All right, but on the one hand, it makes perfectly good sense to say that at 3 in the morning on an empty highway, 75 miles an hour is perfectly safe. Why should you waste time staying down to 65? So that's the argument for the standard. On the other hand, with the standard, well, you say it was unsafe. I think it was safe. I'll bring in my witnesses. You'll bring in your witnesses. I'll bring in my authorities. And you're going to have a lot of potential litigation. And also with the standard, it's harder for me to avoid litigation by obeying the rule because I don't know if I'm obeying the rule. Since my view of safe may be different. In a system like this where we don't have a good way, if there is a dispute, of settling it, there's much to be said for bright line rules. All right, so what are some of the rules? Well, one of the things they do is to make sure that the legal status only changes when something openly visible happens. So another reason not to have a contract where we agreed to it. Well, we agreed to it. Who hurt us? My secretary heard us. Not very satisfactory. So we say, but on the other hand, if not only did I agree to buy some wheat from you, but I gave you $500 in partial payment, when I gave you $500, you wrote out a receipt for that. Various people saw it. Maybe, I don't know if I gave you the money or my banker gave you the money. It's much more likely that we know what happened, and therefore we've more readily established that this particular deal was made. So part of the way in which you try to do it, and again, the idea that physical transfer is associated with ownership and responsibility, as opposed to, it becomes yours when we decide it's yours or something. So all of those seem like ways of doing that. And there are, I think, in a sense, two different reasons why you want bright line rules, why you would like things where it's very clear who has or hasn't kept the agreement. One of them is you want to avoid accidental conflicts. You want to avoid the case where I honestly believe that I did what I agreed to and you honestly believe I don't. But the other is that you want to make reputational enforcement work better. So if you think about the logic of reputational enforcement, the fuzzier the case it is, the worse reputational enforcement works, because the harder it is for third parties to know who's cheated. All right. Reputational enforcement is sort of interesting because mostly, at least as economists see the world, things get done because people are trying to do them. All right. So that the reason that there is gas available at the corner of my car is that somebody can make money out of providing gas for me, and that's a useful thing. Reputational enforcement isn't like that because when he cheats me and you choose not to do business with him as a result, you're not trying to help me. You're not trying to give him an incentive not to cheat me. Right? What are you trying to do when after he cheats me, you decide not to do business with him? That's right. So your objective is not to enforce things. It's happening indirectly. I mean, that's what's neat about it, as it were. Indirectly, your action is making him an honest man, the knowledge that you'll behave in that way. But you're not trying to make him an honest man, you're just trying only to deal with honest people. But that means that for it to work well, all of the interested third parties have to have an easy way of knowing who cheats them. Suppose that I announce to you, he cheated me. He agreed to do X, Y, and Z, and I paid him the money, and he only did half of it. What do you think his response is going to be?
The other way around.
Of course! No, you did more than we agreed to, and I only paid you 3/4. Now what's your response going to be if you don't have an easy way of knowing which of us is telling the truth? Not to do business with either of us, precisely. If I know that's your response and everybody else's, what do I do when he cheats me? What? Don't say anything. I could prove it, that would be fine. But I'm taking the case where it is not easy for the third parties to find out. Maybe they could find out, but why should you bother? You can always do business with her. She's had gotten into none of these conflicts. So if it's costless for you to find out, then the reputational enforcement works. If it's costly for you to find out, then it doesn't work at two levels. It doesn't work because you're not sure he did it, and it doesn't work because I never complain because I'm afraid you'll think that I'm the one at fault. So that means that a critical factor to making reputational enforcement work is setting things up so that interested third parties can find out who is at fault cheaply. All right, does that make sense? Well, one way of doing it is to structure your contracts so that there are very few ambiguous and iffy things. He can't say, I didn't pay because that beef was rotten. Because once he took delivery of the beef and I've got, six porters who carried the beef into his restaurant or whatever to testify he took delivery of the beef. And once he took delivery of the beef, he owes me the money, whether or not it's good. All right, so that I think is part of what's going on, and again, in trying to make sense of this whole system, is that they want to structure the contract so it'll be obvious. How else might you do it? Suppose for a moment that he and I are entering into this contract in advance, and it's a moderately complicated contract, and we both recognize, each of us recognize the other ones might be a villain, and the other guy knows I might be a villain. And so I say, look, if one of us did cheat the other, it would take a fair amount of effort for somebody else to find out which one was guilty. Other people won't bother to do that. How might we set up the situation to solve that problem? Any ideas? I'm offering a somewhat different explanation for what's in fact quite a common commercial arrangement. What actually happens when two people in the same industry get into a dispute? Where does that dispute usually get settled? Assuming that they don't just settle it themselves. Well, most disputes don't involve labor unions. Arbitration. That's right. If you actually look at sort of commercial disputes, a very large fraction of commercial disputes are going to the American Arbitration Association or the Diamond Dealers Club in New York or whatever organization it is in a particular industry that settles such disputes. Now, under current U.S. law, if we agreed in advance to the arbitration, then the arbitrator's verdict is going to be binding. You can enforcement of court. But that hasn't always been the case, and it isn't always the case now in international disputes. What is the effect of the arbitrator's verdict other than the possibility of enforcing it in court? Why might it be self-enforcing? Do you see? Yes?
So those third parties would be possible for those third parties?
That's right. As long as the arbitrator has a reputation again, or even as long as the third parties know that we agreed on the arbitrator, that might be enough. So if when we signed our contract, which is public information, or we agreed that the American Arbitration Association could settle it, or if everybody knows that in our industry these things go to the New York Diamond Dealers Club, then when they arbitrate the dispute and say, he's the villain, he owes $50,000 just to him, and he hasn't paid it, now you, the interested third party, don't have to investigate the facts. All you have to do is ask, what did the arbitrator say? So that one of the ways you can look at commercial arbitration is as a mechanism for reducing information costs to interested third parties, which seems to me an interesting sort of angle on the whole issue of arbitration, which of course is one of the things somebody could write a paper about if they wanted. What? Of reducing costs to interested third parties. That's one way of looking at arbitration, especially arbitration when it doesn't have the sanction of state enforcement. What originally got me thinking about some of this stuff was some old work done by Lisa Bernstein, I think, who's now at Chicago. She wasn't then. Who investigated, in fact, the diamond industry. And as I remember the story, in the old days, before actually the time when she was looking into it, the New York diamond industry was dominated by Orthodox Jews. and they regard it as a violation of their religious obligations to sue each other. And therefore, they needed, just like the Chinese, a different way of solving these problems. And that different way was arbitration, that diamond dealing, these are, I guess, both cut and uncut, I'm not sure, mostly cut diamonds, is a trust-intensive industry, that I'm handing you an envelope which I say contains, you know, 100 quarter carat grade such and such diamonds. It takes you an awful lot of time to take every one of those little tiny quarter carat diamonds and test it. So you want to know that my word is good. And so what basically happens, presumably, is you start out in the industry doing small deals. Over time, you build up a reputation. And they, I think, initially had the rabbis, although later it was the Diamond Dealers Club, as a mechanism for arbitrating so other people could find out who would cheat too. So that was sort of an interesting case. Part of the fun of sort of the whole academic project is seeing how the same patterns show up in different places, as it were, which is why I enjoyed doing this paper from China to cyberspace. One of the things hopefully one gets out of this course is to say, aha, those bizarre people, you know, who were running around Africa naked 500 years ago, they were doing just what happened in the courtroom yesterday in San Jose. And sometimes it'll be true. Because although there are differences among human beings, there's also an awful lot of correlation among characteristics of human beings across space and time. Let's see. Other things? Am I desperate enough to start reading my summary of the chapters you've already read? Let me see if there's anything particularly interesting in it. I think I've gone through my sort of general points. Most of it is just stuff that you've just read, so a couple of minutes. Yeah, actually, there's some sort of general issues which had occurred to me, which apply to both this and what we've read for the last week or so, namely Chinese law. And one of the questions is, why wasn't there civil law as we understand it? I don't want to overstate it, because they had law about marriages and land ownership and such, but it was all in the form of criminal law, in the sense that none of it was A has rights against B and goes to the court to vindicate it. It was all A accuses B of some malfeasance and goes to the court to make things good or punish B or something of that sort. And I think part of the answer, though it's only part, is that there's a sort of a preference for hierarchical structures. If you think about it, there's a sense in which there are two different ways in which human activity is organized, both of which always exist to some extent in societies. One of them is the hierarchical structure. How do you find out what you're supposed to do? You ask your boss. How does he find out? He asks his boss, and so forth. And the other is the network of equals interacting under some rules. And that's trade. It's in a certain sense, traffic, if you think about, you know. As you may know, there have been a number of projects to try to design what was sometimes called an intelligent highway. A system which you had traffic control with one central computer telling all the cars where to go. And it hasn't worked. If you're curious, you can talk to Professor Glancy, who was involved in this. Yeah?
The polar opposite is this traffic engineer in Holland. I think he died last year, the year before, Pete Launderman was the town was called Drompton. He removed all of the signs and lights everywhere in the town, apparently traffic accidents and injuries were reduced by 70%. Got a really interesting article about it. The writer painted a picture at the end of the interview with this guy. He said, if you don't believe that it's safe, I can prove it to you once and for all. He's standing on the edge of a busy traffic circle into the entry of the town where all of the accidents just happened. And he just lets himself fall. And all of the traffic just works itself around him. And it's like the point would be decentralized.
But in practice, you have both happening to varying degrees, that, you know, individual firms are hierarchical but are dealing with each other mostly as equals and so forth. And it may be that part of what's going on is that civil law is a law among equals, criminal law is a law with a hierarchy enforcing rules, and that the Imperial Chinese culture, or at least the government of the Imperial Chinese culture, had a strong preference for seeing it in that way. And sort of one of the things that's striking in the chapter is when they give you that one of the cases where the guy is writing his petition, as it were, to the court. And the petition to the court is nothing about, I've got a right to be paid, or it's your job to make sure that this guy who borrowed my money pays it back. No, it's a poor, humble person, and I'll be hungry this winter if you don't do this. And, you know, it's all from an assumption which is explicitly not claiming any authority over the authorities, as it were. It's not the way we tend to think of a lot of these things, but rather, I realize I'm at the bottom of the totem pole, but won't you, as a benevolent ruler up there, do what I want you to do? And I think that fits also the whole business about discouraging any private practice of law, because you don't want to have people who are telling the citizens, look, this is what the law says, they can't do that to you because the law doesn't let them. It should be, if anybody tells them we can't do anything, it's us who tell them. And one of the things that makes me wonder about is to what extent hierarchy is built into human beings. Because certainly there are species in which, to varying degrees, it seems to be, in which things tend to organize the way others in which they don't. And one of the things I thought about is sort of imagine meeting three different people. One of them you happen to know is very wealthy. One of them you happen to know is a best-selling author of books you really like. And one of them is the president of the U.S. And if you think about your emotional reaction to that experience, and if it's not the president of the U.S., it could, for that matter, be your boss if you're an employee of a firm, that there's a different tone, as it were. You'll have respect for all three of them. They've all accomplished impressive things. But the tone of the person who you see is in a hierarchical authority above you, you sort of feel differently towards him. There's a little bit of built-in cringe, as it were, which I don't think you have with regard to the people who are, in some sense, very high-status people, but not high-status people with any authority over you. And that may be one part of what's going on. Sort of you think of the world as always in a tension between functional decentralized systems and hardwired feelings for hierarchy. A related point, which also occurred to me a long time ago, if you get into arguments about sort of what's just or what ought to happen, or a lot of political arguments, I feel as though there are two different, almost unrelated intuitions built into our moral feelings. And one of them is what I think of as desert, and the other is what I think of as entitlement. And I'm getting this distinction largely from a philosopher called Nozick who wrote about it. So that if... Very simple case. You buy a lottery ticket and you win $100,000. Did you deserve $100,000? Well, you didn't do anything in particular. You're no more virtuous, nice person than any of 1,000 other people. No, you didn't deserve $100,000. Are you entitled to $100,000? Of course you're entitled to $100,000. You see how there's sort of two different judgments, both of which feel like moral judgments, and yet they're of a different sort. Because one way of thinking about it that I at least find useful is that desert is a God's eye view of the world. Say, imagine somebody who really knew everything about everybody. And he could say, well, he seems sort of hard-hearted, but I actually know that he goes out of his way to be kind to people in all sorts of ways. Whereas that person, yeah, he's very generous and anybody is watching, but what kind of an SOB is he when they aren't? So that person knew everything about people, as it were, as I think of it as a God's eye view. He could say, you deserve to win that $100,000 lottery. And of course, if he's God, he can arrange you to win the $100,000 lottery too. On the other hand, ordinary people in a world of equals, even if I know, I mean, you know, it's almost trite to say, you know, that wonderful person just came down with cancer. All right, what can I do about it? Not a goddamn thing. So in that sense, but what I can do is to say, what do I owe people? If I owe it to them, I can pay them. What do people owe me? So if you think of the entitlement as sort of moral relations among equals, which aren't really statements about what anybody deserves. They are only statements about, I made this promise, I've got to keep it. I borrowed this money, I have to return it. All things like that. That's one of the ways in which we evaluate the world. A different one is to say, but isn't it unfair that good, virtuous, deserving person is employed at minimum wage, living in a hovel, and so forth. And I think both of those, as they go into our feelings about the world, and that's sort of one of the interesting, to me at least, features of introspection, of trying to understand how I think, and how everybody, I think, thinks, as far as I can tell. All right, anything else? I got off on the digressions basically because I ran out of stuff I was going to talk about. So I will now turn off.